Welcome to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source, grassroots, and partially solar-powered community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of the show is Life and Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. This show provides practical, general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. Please get some notebook, paper, and pen so you can take notes during the show. First, we look at some debt-related news and facts for the week. From the New York Times, an article written by Andrew Martin, Learning How to Fight the Debt Collector. Among debt collectors, Stephen Katz is known as a credit terrorist. For years, he has run what he calls the Stephen Katz School of Bill Collector Education, otherwise known as the Credit Terrorist Training Camp. Mr. Katz, a 58-year-old accountant in suburban Tucson, spends his free time schooling debtors on the finer points of consumer protection law to help turn the tables on debt collectors. On occasion, he thumbs his own nose at them, too. "How many times can I sue you? Let me count the ways," he wrote under his pseudonym Dr. Tax in a March posting on Inside Arm, a debt collector's website. A former bill collector himself, Mr. Katz rebelled after a debt buyer damaged his credit score with what he says was a bogus bill. Mr. Katz sued, and in 2001, he collected his first damage award, a $1,000 check that he now keeps framed behind his desk. The bill collectors, when they call, make you feel like the only option you have is to lay down and play dead. "That's not true," said Mr. Katz, who does not charge for his advice. "Nothing validates this more than getting a check. Call this movement Revenge of the Alleged Deadbeats. Even as collectors try to recoup debt from millions of Americans struggling to pay their bills, a small but growing number of lawyers and consumers are fighting back against what they describe as harassment, unscrupulous practices, and, most important to their litigiousness, violations of the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act. In fact, 8,287 federal lawsuits were filed citing violations of the Act in 2009, a 60% rise over the previous year, according to Web Recon, a site that tracks collection-related litigation and the most litigious consumers and lawyers on behalf of debt collectors. Last week, the U.S. Supreme Court made it even easier for consumers to use the courts to fight debt collectors, ruling that collectors cannot be shielded from suits by claiming they made a mistake in interpreting the law. When a consumer stops paying a bill, creditors often try to collect on their own for a few months. In many instances, the creditor hires another company to collect the debt. In other cases, they may dispose of the debt by selling it to a debt buyer for a steep discount. Debt collectors and debt buyers are the targets of litigious consumers, since the debt collection law primarily applies to third-party collectors. Peter Barry, a Minneapolis trial lawyer, is so bullish on the future of debt collection litigation that he holds several boot camps each year to share his secrets with other lawyers who want in on the action. If the debtor wins a court case under the Act, the debt collector must pay the lawyer's fees. The next boot camp is being held in early May in San Francisco at the cost of $2,495 a person for 2.5 days of instruction. "I can't sue every illegal debt collector in America, although I'd like to try," Mr. Barry said. Mr. Katz can also claim some credit for the increase in lawsuits. For 6 years, he has run a free website called debtorboards.com, where people share tips on topics like keeping a paper trail and recording calls from collectors.
Again, that's debtorbaards.com. Mr. Katz said the site received 2 million hits in 2009, a 60% increase over the previous year. Debtor Boards is geared to help people use the laws as they are on the books as both a shield and a sword, said Mr. Katz, who says he has won $36,000 from his own litigation against collection agencies. Note, since many of the settlements are confidential, it is difficult to prove the claims of Mr. Katz and others. But of course, debt collectors are hardly pleased with the litigation trend. Roseanne Anderson, chief executive of ACA International, a trade association for the debt collection industry, said she was extremely concerned about the increase in lawsuits, which she said cost her industry hundreds of millions of dollars a year. She said much of the increase was the result of ambiguous language in the Fair Debt Collection Act. Debt collectors are required, for example, to identify themselves on a voice message left for a consumer, she said, but they are also prohibited from telling a third party, including someone who might overhear a phone message, about a consumer's debt. We are in between a rock and a hard place, Ms. Anderson said. Ms. Anderson said she had little patience for websites that encourage consumers to thwart debt collectors. We believe those types of websites are encouraging people to not take responsibility for just debt, she said. Jack Gordon, who runs fee-based Web Recon site, said it was no wonder lawsuits were increasing because consumers were being bombarded with ads from lawyers when they searched online for information on debt collection. He said the proliferation of discussion sites like Mr. Katz's had, to a lesser extent, also contributed to the trend. On the boards, he said, there's a lot of hot air, a lot of people who overinflate their accomplishments. Regardless, Mr. Gordon's database has become a badge of honor among the devotees of debtorboards.com. As Brandon Scrogan, a 37-year-old from Little Rock, Arkansas, put it, that's one list I'm a proud card-carrying member of. Mr. Scrogan, who provides price estimates at a body shop, said he was the type of person who refused to be taken advantage of, even for petty offenses. For instance, years ago, he said he joined in the class action suit against the pop group Milli Vanilli, accused of lip-syncing, and collected a $1.25 check. Now, after a messy divorce, Mr. Scrogan was stuck with a $7,000 bill that he said belonged to his ex-wife. Instead of paying it, he began researching the law and stumbled on debtorboards.com. Armed with lessons he learned on the site, he demanded proof of the debt from the collection agency, and the calls stopped. But 2.5 years later, they started up again, so he sued the collection agency, National Loan Recoveries, for failing to provide proof of the debt, among other things. The case was settled in 2008. The terms were confidential, but he says he never paid National Loan a dime. Let's just say I'm a very happy person. A lawyer for National Loan, Catherine Bridges, did not return messages seeking comment. Mr. Katz said his website was not intended to help people avoid paying legitimate debts. But if they do so, so be it. He feels no need to apologize. He said Congress gave consumers certain rights, and he is simply making people aware of them, sometimes colorfully. As Mr. Katz says at the bottom of each Dr. Tax posting, a telephone in the hands of a collector is like a crowbar. It can be used to pry a mouth open wide enough to insert a foot. Barbara Thompson, 46, of Atlanta, said she challenged $11,000 in credit card debt using online research about collection laws. She does not dispute the debt, but reasons that the credit card company wrote off her charges long ago. By her account, she owes the credit card company, not the debt collector. The credit card company, they sell it off. They charge it off. It's just business as usual, she said, adding, I'm adamant about not paying a collection agency. So that's from Learning How to Fight the Debt Collector, an article in the New York Times. I'd like to also mention that Iowans have the benefit of another law that protects against harassing and improper debt collection from the original creditor, not just debt collectors. And this extends the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act to a broader protective level. If you are just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. So now let's move over to what we've been studying for some months, the two-income trap, why middle-class parents are going broke. This is a book by Elizabeth Warren and her daughter Amelia Warren Tyagi, who are two of America's leading champions for debtors, particularly middle-class debtors. And I give credit to them because the thoughts, ideas, and examples used in these programs are directly from or based on the work, theories, and book of both Elizabeth Warren and her daughter, Amelia Warren Tyagi. And I highly recommend their books, principally All Your Worth and The Two-Income Trap. You should also visit the archives at www.kruufm.com under Life and Debt, and you can listen to all of the shows that have been produced to help you deal with debt. Last week, I was discussing the brave new unregulated world, which is a hot topic for Professor Warren. There is the issue of how millions of seemingly ordinary middle-class families did find themselves falling off a financial cliff just at the time when parents got caught in a vicious bidding war for middle-class housing, just as the cost of college tuition and health insurance shot into the stratosphere, and just as layoffs increased and the divorce rate jumped, we saw this new player, which is a newly deregulated lending industry eager to lend a few bucks whenever the family came up short. And it's an important issue because this is clarifying what truly happened and not this concept of the irresponsible consumer causing the debt, but the tactics used to give credit to consumers. If we pick up almost any newspaper, there will be a story about America's most widespread addiction. And this has been, over the last decade, the insatiable hunger for debt. Every year for the past two decades, mortgage debt has set a new record. And within the last 2 years, that actually has a lot to do with the defaulted mortgages and all the foreclosure costs. Home equity loans grew, increasing by over 150% in just 4 years. And we're all familiar with the phrase, no one would dare leave home without a fistful of those little plastic cards. Don't leave home without it. The news media rarely give an explanation for why all the debt piled up, leaving the reader to infer that the debt explosion is some sort of inevitable byproduct of today's moral and economic climate. But Professor Warren points out and underlines one very critical point. Americans did not wake up one morning and decide en masse that they needed stuff so much that they'd be delighted to take on a big fat second mortgage and they'd be thrilled to skip a credit card payment or two, as we see implied in headline after headline. Nor was there a sudden, quote, national conspiracy of people who buy credit cards and then max them out, end quote, as one prominent professor of finance claimed. As we discussed last week, those mountains of debt were made possible by one very important change that largely went unnoticed in all the discussions about Americans in debt. A seemingly small modification in the laws of consumer finance, a tiny change that transformed centuries of family economics in an instant, according to the professor. Just a generation ago, the average family simply couldn't get into the kind of financial hole that has become so familiar today. The reason was straightforward, and we all know it from ourselves or our parents. A middle-class family couldn't borrow very much money. High-limit, all-purpose credit cards did not exist for those with average means. There were no mortgages available for 125% of the home's value, and no offers in the Daily Mail or on the internet for second and third home equity loans. Did not exist. And also, there were no offers to consolidate all that debt by moving it from one credit card to another. So a generation ago, a family that wanted to borrow money had only a handful of options. Instead of running up debt anonymously, a prospective borrower was forced to meet a very stern-looking banker face-to-face. Families were asked to produce past tax returns, pay stubs, credit references, projected budgets that showed how they planned to repay the money. If they wanted to take out a mortgage for a new home, they were typically required to come up with a 20% down payment from their own savings, not the option loans that we see today, where some people are only paying interest on the loans, and in some loans, they can choose not to pay anything during a month. Not recognizing the adjustable rate and ballooning that is going to be fatal to their mortgage. And then if people wanted money for any other purpose, they were required to give a detailed account of their spending plans, and the banker had a fairly narrow set of answers he wanted to hear. Building an extra bedroom on the house, buying a new car, sending the kids off to college. Fairly standard, down-to-earth reasons. Back then, some retailers offered credit to move their merchandise, but cash loans and lines of credit for making ends meet until the laid-off spouse finds a new job or putting groceries on the table until the kids' child support checks begin, these were not available. They were not in the lexicon. And when we look at it, the reason for the lender's cautious approach was not that the bankers of yesteryear were thriftier or that Americans hadn't yet developed a taste for unbridled consumption. The reason essentially was a far more powerful one, and it affected every lender and every borrower in the country. And what's that reason? The law was different. In those days, the banking industry was highly, highly regulated, and usury laws created ironclad limits on how much interest a bank could charge on a loan. Just as an aside, in biblical terms, usury was any interest. However, in modern times, that's not the case. Usury is excessive interest. But when we look at it, banks' profit margins were modest back then, and families that wanted to borrow money had to prove that they had a very high likelihood of repaying it. Sounds smart, sounds wise, and sounds unlike today. And as Professor Warren points out, this judgment was not moralistic. It was supported by stubborn financial reality. Unlike today, bank vaults were firmly closed to families already in financial trouble. If you're just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. And we're talking about the way banking regulation was a generation ago and how it had changed, particularly how, in the past, people who had financial difficulties could not get money. And this was all very carefully analyzed at the point of giving the loan. From the founding of the Republic through the late 1970s, interest rates had been a matter for states to determine, and the states had imposed limits on the amounts of interest that could be charged on consumer loans. The logic behind the laws was straightforward. State governments wanted to protect their citizens from back-alley loan sharks and aggressive lenders who would cost families their homes. Again, this is in counterpoint to what has happened and all the homes that are being lost. So what happened? The state's authority to regulate lending within their borders was wiped out by an obscure federal regulation. In 1978, a Supreme Court opinion interpreting some ambiguous language in a little-known federal statute opened the door for banks to export interest rates from one state to another. What this meant was that a bank with lending operations in South Dakota, where the interest ceiling was 24%, at a time when the rates in most states were capped at 12 to 18%, would have a distinct advantage. A South Dakota bank could now issue loans at 24% interest to a family living in New York, where rates on most loans were capped at 12%, without worrying about the corporate officers ending up in a New York prison next to loan sharks who collected by breaking people's fingers until they paid. So that's a nice setup for the corporate officer. Can we get this loan at the highest interest rate in the land to people across the country? So that Supreme Court decision, which was the new law of the land, allowed South Dakota banks to collect their profits from New York families, and there wasn't a thing the New York legal system could do about it anymore. Now, what was the aftermath of that? Well, it created a race. Local politicians across the country quickly figured out all they had to do was raise the interest rate ceiling, and lending institutions would flock back to their states because they actually were flocking to South Dakota. Now, you see a competition being ignited here. Suddenly, there was a new way for states to attract clean, white-collar jobs and even grab a share of corporate taxes in the process. And in a casual fashion, sure, there might be some hardship for families that stumbled into high-interest loans they really couldn't afford, but most of the hardship would be exported to the residents of other states, while the benefits, jobs and tax revenues, would stay local. Professor Warren looks at this. She says, well, now let's just think about it. Suppose, by way of analogy, we look at America's drug laws, and South Dakota passed a law, and the federal government permitted it, that made it legal to grow marijuana inside the state and to sell it anywhere in the country. Not like California. South Dakota would bear only a tiny fraction of the total social costs of marijuana used, while reaping 100% of the profits from sales elsewhere. Suddenly, the downside of marijuana use that once made legalization unthinkable, again, except in California, drug addiction, health problems, traffic accidents, and so forth, might start to look pretty insignificant next to all those dollars the state could rake in. Now that's her analogy. Maybe some people don't like it, but it is an interesting analogy. All politics aside, here we see that lenders began to see possibilities opened up by the new laws. And this is the birth of the financial debacle we're in right now. What happens? The bottom line is that no longer would credit be a prized commodity doled out parsimoniously. By the mid-1980s, credit had become a highly profitable consumer product, like running shoes, soft drinks, or record albums, and the new game was to sell as much as possible. That leads to the question, how do you manage the risk that some customers might default on the debt? Simple. Move the lending operations to South Dakota or Delaware, which quickly followed South Dakota's lead, and then raise the interest rate for consumers across the country. Banks would lose money on some credit card customers, but thanks to the higher interest rates, those losses would be more than offset by the profits on the rest. No financial genius here. As we know, by keeping track of all this, over the past two decades, bad debt losses and loan write-offs have soared, yes, but profits for these banks have risen even faster. In this new sky's-the-limit world, the stern-faced banker and the long application forms have been replaced by chirpy advertisements and pre-approved credit offers. You've all received them. Banks can now lend to anyone and everyone, including those in financial trouble, and still make a handsome profit. So this is the birth of American debt in its mutant form.
Today, we see a debt explosion. There's a new world of unregulated lending. Families are barraged with advertisements and offers for new products, which is all the debt they could want and more.
Up until the recent crisis in the economy, in single years, more than 5 billion
pre-approved credit card offers totaling over $350,000 of credit per family poured into mailboxes all across America. We have this crisis that we're living in, and yet within the last week, my wife received at least 5 pre-approved credit card offers. So the crisis has not changed the basic thinking driven by profit from the credit card companies. It's just changed its approach a little bit considering the new law and the terms that are written in their contracts. But offers are still coming. There was a period when magazine ads, telephone calls during dinner, and flyers at the bottom of grocery store bags were barraging families with more and more offers of credit. And for those of you with kids in college, or if you're in college yourself, you know that there are roving bands of credit card marketers who still haunt college campuses and shopping malls. And one reason for this, in spite of the credit crisis, is that much of this debt is still sold off as soon as it arises into a portfolio. And so the lender is not using its own money in effect. Just looking at this historical growth, credit card debt increased from less than $10 billion in 1968, and when we adjusted for inflation, to more than $600 billion in the year 2000, which is an increase of more than 6,000%. Now, as of February 2010, revolving credit card debt was $858 billion. Non-revolving credit card debt was $1,589 billion, which currently makes a total of $2,447 billion in debt. Now, there's this whole debate about averages versus medians and analyzing the statistics that way. However, there's a heck of a lot of debt out there, no matter how you cut it or analyze it. And it seems that once Americans got a first bite at the debt apple, they just couldn't get enough. And that's regardless of how statisticians play with numbers. But an important question is, what are the families spending all the money on? Did they blow it on vacations and luxury items, which some politicians claim? This kind of explanation would gratify the self-righteous bill payers, but it doesn't square with the facts. Undoubtedly, all that easy credit dangling under everyone's noses enticed a few more Americans into buying things that they could live without. There's no debate about that. As Professor Warren had pointed out and we discussed in past shows, today's families are spending more on some goods, such as computers, home electronics, and pet food, than they did a generation ago. But they're spending less on food, clothing, appliances, home furnishings, and tobacco. A lot less. There's no real evidence of an increase in impulse buying or luxury acquisitions over the past 40 years. Certainly nothing that could account for a 6,000% increase in credit card debt at the turn of the century from the late 60s to, at minimum, what would be almost a 9,000% increase today on revolving credit alone. And one last point for today, the expenditures that have shown the biggest increases are housing, health insurance, college tuition, preschool. Now, of course, those are the purchases least likely to appear on a credit card bill. So we'll end with a question. If families aren't buying more goods, then what are they using all that debt for? And we will continue to explore that idea next week. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life in Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeanddebt@gmail.com. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous, debt manageable life.